You're listening to This Week in Palestine, a space where truth is unflinching, resistance is sacred, and solidarity is never up for negotiation. Here, voices from the heart of occupation rise to meet global movements demanding justice, dignity, and liberation. Each week, we bring you fearless reporting, sharp analysis, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, defiance, and humanity. We examine the machinery of empire, from the policies that suffocate to the propaganda that distorts, and trace its echoes across borders, linking Ferguson to Jenin, refugee camps to classrooms, and Gaza to the global conscience. Before we begin, a brief note. The views expressed during this hour belong to our hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. This is not a space for polite avoidance or sanitized sound bites. It is a space for truth, bold, urgent, and unapologetic. Good morning, good evening, wherever you're tuning in from, thank you for being here. I'm your host, Yara Rashid, and it's a deep and humbling honor to welcome you back to This Week in Palestine. Today is Sunday, September 28, 2025. Once again, our attention turns to Gaza and the West Bank, lands under siege, where homes lie in ruins, lives are uprooted, and voices struggle to rise above the noise of global indifference. As headlines fade and attention shifts, the truth remains. Families endure relentless displacement. Communities resist with unshakable resolve. And the pursuit of dignity continues against staggering odds. And still, one question refuses to fade. How long must a people suffer before the world chooses conscience over convenience, action over apathy? Stay with us as we strip away the silence, uplift resilience, and carry forward the flame of justice. This journey is not mine alone. It's ours. It's shared. It's urgent. And it's sacred. Today, we bring you a powerful interview that refuses to flinch. Palestinian-American novelist and activist Susan Abulhawa joins journalist Ahmed Shihab El-Din for a searing conversation about Gaza, not just as a place under siege, but as a moral and political crossroads for humanity. Abulhawa describes the Israeli assault on Gaza as genocide and collective punishment, rejecting the false framing of a war between equals. She critiques the global architecture of complicity, from the silence of Arab regimes to the performative neutrality of Western institutions, and insists that rage, when rooted in truth and transformed into action, is not only valid, but necessary. The interview dives deep into the ways language and media distort reality, using euphemisms to mask colonial violence. Abulhawa reflects on her recent visit to Gaza, sharing the unbearable suffering she witnessed firsthand, and previews a forthcoming Gaza anthology that seeks to preserve voices often erased. She calls on artists, writers, and cultural workers to speak boldly, especially when truth is inconvenient. Throughout the conversation, Abulhawa centers the resilience of Palestinians, especially children, as living testaments to hope and endurance.
She reminds us that Gaza is not just a tragedy, it is a test of global conscience. And how we respond will shape the moral trajectory of our time. This episode closes with a call to multiply rage into resistance, to reject silence, and to let Gaza define the future we choose. Let's dive in.
You say things that are so honest.
I don't give a shit about anybody's feelings. When people, humans, children are being shredded, are being burned alive, like, why is that even a topic to discuss at this hour?
How do you navigate a society that often cheers the system that is erasing us?
It's horrible watching this from afar. The whole world feels like a lie outside of Gaza. All these hammers that they beat the rest of the world over with, their free speech and their democracy, and it's all bullshit. Gaza's really pulling those masks off, right? I mean, it's literally exposing everybody.
Yeah.
And their lies and their bullshit.
How do you hold that weight? And what does it reveal about the edges of human endurance?
It is the most natural thing in the world to be angry, to be enraged, and that's okay. It can be fuel. Change doesn't happen when you stay within the bounds that they've already set for you. Israel should be wiped from the earth in the same way that Nazism was wiped away, in the same way that apartheid was wiped away. They are moving in a scientific way to resurrect naked colonialism in a way that is more horrific than anything humanity has ever experienced. It is driven by technology. It is driven by AI. It's a window into the future. And if people think it's going to stop with us, they are tragically mistaken.
Welcome back to Out Loud. Today, I'm deeply honored to sit down with Susan Abulhawa. She's written Mornings in Jenin, which etched the Nakba's wounds into a global bestseller. She's written searing essays like Love in the Time of Genocide, where she weaves stories of heroism amid Israel's relentless slaughter. When I asked you to join me, Susan, it was really to help us all channel this burning rage into something constructive, to turn the fury into action against a world that's enabling Israel's Holocaust in Gaza. I want to start with the ground you've walked. You've been to Gaza in the last 2 years. I want to know what pulled you to go there, to face that crucible, and what you left with.
I think we all want to go to Gaza, right? I want to go back, and I had planned to go back. It's horrible watching this from afar. The whole world feels like a lie outside of Gaza. It took a lot from Gaza, but it's really this feeling that the whole world is a lie, and I want to go back there despite the horrors. And I've said this before. I mean, I say as much as I write, I'm still at a loss for words to really capture the enormity of what's happening, the depravity of what's happening, the moral abyss of allowing this to continue, the just unbearable inhumanity, the sadism. To call them demonic is not enough. To call them sadistic is not enough. To call this a Holocaust is not big enough. Calling it a Holocaust, the Holocaust of our time, is not enough.
Why?
This isn't just a major moment in our lifetimes in geopolitical history. This is a hinge, a real pivot and turning point that's going to determine not just Palestine's fate, but the fate of humanity. You know, the president of Colombia said it, that, you know, this is rich nations teaching us, showing us what they're going to do to us if and when we step out of line. I want to say it's not the West, right? Because it's not the totality of the West. It is a ruling elite of Westerners who are developing a new model that is going to subjugate people around the world.
Subjugating people around
exactly,
the world.
Exactly. But this is different. I mean, they're really developing a model wherein they will do the unthinkable, the unfathomable, the things that they thought they could never get away with on camera. They're doing it and they're getting away with it. And they're developing a model of how to do that. What they do is not random. It's grounded in science, but there are scientific and psychological principles that they are operating from to basically disempower the world, to make it clear that nothing we do will make them stop. That is the lesson that they're trying to get across to people. And it's not just in Gaza. I mean, they've been doing this for decades. We saw this like For example, during the Iraq War, hundreds of thousands of people flooded the streets and made it clear that we didn't want this. The world did not want this, but they did it anyway. And then people just stopped, right? And so then they decided to do it in Libya, and nobody batted an eye.
Mm-hmm.
So it is they do the unthinkable. We protest, we are outraged, and then they escalate. They do something even bigger and more horrible. And then we just stop because we are disempowered. And there is a psychology, there's psychological principles that underpin this. Mm-hmm. They are moving in a scientific way to resurrect naked colonialism in a way that is more horrific than anything humanity has ever experienced. It is driven by technology. It is driven by AI. It's a window into the future. And if people think it's going to stop with us, they are tragically mistaken.
No, and that's why I keep hearing people who are waking up, for lack of a better word, talk about how this is so much bigger than Palestine. And even though I don't love that framing, I know exactly what they mean. And it's what you're talking about. The consolidation of power is frightening, and how they're, you know, wielding it. Susan, I do want to ask you, in your Democracy Now! Interview, you called what you saw in Gaza a Holocaust, slaughter, starvation, a deliberate erasure of a people, everything that it is. What does it mean to name it so boldly, to carry the truth when the world demands euphemisms? I mean, watching your commentary, either on X or, you know, even at Oxford Union, you say things that are so honest, so accurate. People say to me, yeah, well, Susan's incredible because of this, this, and this, and she doesn't seem to give a fuck anymore. What do you think that is that people are noticing? Do you just not give a fuck? I mean, I often say I've been radicalized because I like to take the term that they use to demonize and dehumanize. I think millions of people around the world have been radicalized. How do you hold that weight? And what does it reveal about the edges of human endurance?
First of all, I tried to say this long before. I mean, this is how I felt for a long time until X changed hands. Anytime I tried to say what I wanted to say, I was removed or canceled and whatnot. But now X really allows a broader spectrum of free speech. And I am grateful for that, I have to say, regardless of what I think about Musk. And there is a part of it of not giving a fuck, right? But it's not, it's more than that. It's just, it's a loyalty to the truth. It's a loyalty to our ancestors.
Sorry, I don't mean to interject, mm-hmm. but that's how I feel. Like, what about this decorum? You want us to like maintain decorum while you're...
So exactly, like I absolutely reject the policing of my speech when we're being exterminated. I don't give a shit about your feelings. I don't give a shit about anybody's feelings when people, humans, children are being shredded, are being burned alive. Like, why is that even a topic to discuss at this hour? We are angry. Yes, we're angry. We're enraged. And I think, and this is something I've tried to talk about and inspire people to do long before the beginning of this genocide, is to kind of reject these, this Western notion these contours of how we're supposed to act are all imposed on us. They're not natural. It's not natural to be kind and polite when we're seeing the things that we're seeing. It's unnatural. It is the most natural thing in the world to be angry, to be enraged. And that's okay, right? It doesn't mean you're about to, you know, shoot up people and stuff. That's not it. It means that you were honest. It means that we have this very natural feeling and reaction to something that should not happen in the world. And it can be fuel. If you allow that anger and rage to become a fuel, it is actually hugely empowering. And I think people should embrace their anger. Society teaches you not to be angry, right? It teaches you that anger is irrational, but it's not. And the reason these principles are part of this construct of decorum and civility is precisely because the thing that oppressors fear the most is the anger of the masses, mm-hmm. right? That's it. Because so they put it in our heads that it's not polite, it's not rational to be angry. But I say, no, it's natural to be angry. It is empowering to be angry. It is a fuel. And I'm honest. I just, Israel is demonic. It is the sadism that they are exhibiting.
Yeah.
Should have no place among humanity. This entity should be wiped from the map. Now, people sort of decide and they interpret that as I'm calling for the genocide of Jews. I mean, that's bullshit. That's a, you know, that's a very convenient interpretation, as they always, you know, they kind of project their own intentions onto us. But no, that's not it. Israel should be wiped from the earth in the same way that Nazism was wiped away, in the same way that apartheid was wiped away. And, you know, people who want to stay there and live as equals, live like other humans live there, they're welcome to do so. No matter how long it takes, how many generations, whatever the cost, our goal should be to remove this cancer from the midst of humanity. And I make no apologies for saying that.
And I appreciate that so much. Your clarity is inspiring to me. I want to elaborate on channeling the rage and anger. You've described the reality on the ground as infinitely worse than the worst videos we see in the West. Beyond the, you know, burials alive and bodies shredded, there is a massive degradation of life, right? Reducing a high-functioning society in Gaza to this primal, I mean, that's what kills me. And my sister said this to me the other day. She's a huge fan of yours. And she said to me, when I told her that we'd be speaking, she's like, what kills me is that this is now the identity they're trying to impose on us as Palestinians, right? Like we're you know, desperate for food. And I guess, how does witnessing this total denigration of a whole people fuel your rage? Like, what are the actual feelings that it stirs in you? And has that shifted as you try to convey it, as you do so brilliantly, to those who haven't seen it or haven't fully felt it?
If somebody hasn't fully felt it by this point, they're not worth my time, honestly. I'm not trying to speak to specific people. I speak and I write the truth as I see it, and people can do with it whatever they want. It's up to individuals to do their own work in this life, mm-hmm. in their lives. Mm-hmm. I can provide the books. I can provide the testimony. I can provide the analysis. But that's all I can do. I can't control people's minds and hearts. And I can hope that people have enough conscience and humanity to take that and do something with it. And there are a lot of people who do care. And so I suppose ultimately that's who I'm speaking to. Just because people sort of instinctively feel the injustice doesn't mean that they know the facts, doesn't mean they understand the political reality or the physical reality of what's happening. That's who I'm speaking to, although I don't ever really have a specific audience in mind.
What's it like as a Palestinian living, you know, in the U.S. while our people are being erased by the U.S.? How does that dissonance feel for you? How does it play out? And how do you navigate a society that often cheers the system that is erasing us?
Yeah, I mean, so many of us really want to leave, honestly. And I have really actually put a plan in motion to finally do that. And it will happen. But there's also an argument to be made for people doing the work here. Both are legitimate paths.
I guess if I can just interject briefly, it just so happened that I moved to Tunisia a month before October 7th. And I did it for my own reasons. And then, you know, October 7th happened, I think all of our lives changed. And I can't tell you how grateful I was to be out of all places in Tunis, because I not only didn't have to navigate what people in the West have to navigate with Zionism and the whole anti-Semitism thing, but even comparatively relative to the Arab world. I mean, Tunis, it was like I would tell people, cab drivers, I was Palestinian, and they'd stop the car and break down crying. And this is in early October, and it kept happening to the point where I started telling people, just so I could get through my day, that I was Syrian and Lebanese. not to suggest that those people aren't suffering. I guess I want to say you're so unafraid to condemn Israel in the rawest and realest terms. You know, what roots this fearlessness, if I can call it that, in you when you've seen some people sort of shrink away from the backlash for whatever reason? Is it just what you said earlier, or is there something about you as a person who's, like, before October 7th, just were you always sort of willing to challenge the status quo, or did you evolve?
I think we're all evolving. We all change. And certainly this moment in history has changed all of us. But and I don't really want to focus on me as a person, because this is something, you know, it's not about me ultimately or my personality. But I will say that I believe that you have to pay a price, right? You have to be willing to pay a price. None of this is cheap. Change doesn't happen when you stay within the bounds that they've already set for you.
Comfort and the comfort of capitalism.
Exactly.
Yep.
And, you know, at the end of the day, I have to say I am immensely inspired by the resistance. Imagine what they're facing, mm-hmm. right? And I just feel like I feel so small. What I do is so small compared to the courage that they exhibit. These are young men in the prime of their lives with their whole lives ahead of them. They're holed up underground. They're starving. Their families are killed. This army of orphans. And they're facing off with the most powerful countries in the world who have ganged up on them in this tiny strip of land. And all they have are homemade weapons that they actually recycle from unexploded ordnances that have been dropped on them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if people were not so racist, if they had not been so programmed to see these warriors as terrorists, they would understand the epic, unprecedented heroism that they exhibit. Against all odds. I mean, and the persistence that they show. 2 years on and they're still fighting.
Mm-hmm.
2 years on, over 85,000 tons of bombs dropped on them. A starvation campaign, and they're still fighting. So I see that and it inspires me. Who am I to stop? Who am I to think that, you know, I mean, what are they going to do to me, right? Take my house, take my money, kill me, whatever. I'm 55 years old, right? I've lived a life. I am willing to offer that, right? It's the least we can do because, and I think Palestinians in general, this has been sort of driven into all of us.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you die standing, right? You don't die on your knees. We're all gonna die. And you don't live in this world on your knees. And mm-hmm. and I think that's really important. I think it kills you. It kills your body. It makes your body diseased when you live in a way that where internally you accept humiliation just in order to see another day, when you accept degradation.
And Susan, I don't want to make it about you, but amid the unbearable grief, if I can call it that, that we're all feeling. I mean, when Enes, the Al Jazeera reporter, was assassinated, like so many others, I just couldn't contain my feelings. I had to sort of retreat and, like, you know, mourn in my own way. And I was mourning his life, of course, but I was mourning so many other things. And, you know, what came to my mind is how you write about Gaza's acts of love. You know, you write about the heroism, the ingenuity, as you just described, with the weapons. I mean, is that what sparks hope for you when we see all the systems sort of colluding to try to, as you described earlier, you know, try to make us feel like no matter what we do, they're going to just keep oppressing us in Palestine and beyond? I mean, what stories of defiance, particularly if you can share one or two, keep your fire burning and keep hope alive?
I mean, I believe in my heart that Israel is It's not so much stories of defiance. It is kind of being able to zoom out in a historic sense and see what Israel is really all about. Israel has nothing except a military. They have nothing except death and technology and death technology, basically. That's all they have. That's their entire power, right? They are not rooted in the land. They are not rooted in a legal structure. They are not rooted in moral. They have no moral footings. They have no historic foundations. This is a horrific foreign settler colony that has planted itself by force. And ultimately, that, while in the short term, that, you know, that can do a lot of damage, right? But it cannot sustain them. They don't have stories in the land. They don't have roots in the land. They don't have the things that we have that will sustain them. They don't have a real connection to the land. The visceral sadism, the visceral hatred that they feel toward us, mm-hmm. is ultimately rooted in jealousy. It is rooted in their desire to be us. It is rooted in their desire to have the clothing and the songs and the food and their traditions that are so intricately connected to the land. They don't have that, right? And that's what they want. They want the ancient photographs of living and tilling the land and dancing on it. You know, they don't have that. But we do, and they hate us for it. And ultimately, it is our story that they want.
And this is the perfect segue, because I was going to ask you next about your Oxford Union speech last November, which was a lightning strike. I mean, the way at the time that you not only called Israel what it is, an apartheid state committing genocide, and you shared so palpably. When you said things like, you will not erase us, we are the very soil of that land. You flipped the script in a way where, imagining if Palestinians had done to Jews what Zionists do to us, you know, no one would debate these terms like terrorism or genocide. So I guess, how does reclaiming that history, invoking your grandmother's refugee stories, how important is it to challenge the myths that are actually, and have been for decades, propping up our erasure? You had one line that I swear it's memorized like in my heart. You said, you can pretend that falafel and hummus and za'atar are your ancient cuisines, but in the recesses of your being, you will always feel the sting of this epic forgery. Your poetic takedown abilities aside about cultural appropriation, how does it expose the fragility at Zionism's core? And do you think that's a weapon that's being underutilized?
Zionism stands on really shaky grounds. There's a really good story from the 1930s that demonstrates this. Mm-hmm. Winston Churchill was invited by the mayor. Do you know the story of the tree?
No. No. Okay.
So Winston Churchill was invited to come to Tel Aviv, which, you know, was supposedly an ancient Jewish city. And the mayor of Tel Aviv uprooted old trees from Palestinian villages. And he planted them along the road, a main road in Tel Aviv, to make it, you know, seem like this is that they've been there for a while. And as Winston Churchill was coming down the road, you know, everybody was clamoring to get a glimpse of Churchill. And children had climbed on some of these trees and they fell down on the weight of children. And Winston Churchill said to the mayor, you know, something, I can't remember the exact quote, but it was something about if you don't have roots, things will fall down, basically. And this is it, right? Israel doesn't have roots there, and they're crumbling and they're falling. The only thing that they do have are guns. They have weapons. They have death technology. And ultimately, you can't survive on that. Frantz Fanon spoke a lot about the process of decolonization. His core argument was that the biggest aim of colonialism is not just theft of land and resources, but it is the total stripping of indigenous agency, mm-hmm. the total reduction of society, And the ultimate colonization of their minds and the shackling of their imaginations. And the process of decolonization is a process of disalienation, right? A disalienation of from who we are. The narrative, fighting for our stories and our history, is as important as the physical battles to reclaim the land. Mm-hmm. If you can imagine that, imagine on an individual level, a person who gets Alzheimer's, they're no longer who they were. They're gone from the world. Even then, they're still here, right? And healthy, whatever.
Yeah.
But in Alzheimer's, basically erases your stories. So when your stories are gone, your identity is gone.
What's left? Yeah, yeah.
And so you're not. You're just a shell, right? You're just a physical existence. And it's the same on a national level. It's the same on a global level. Right. Mm-hmm. We are our stories, the things that bind us, the things that connect me and you are shared stories. It's shared pain. It's shared language, shared traditions. It's knowing that both of our mothers and grandmothers and foremothers going up the line were cooking the same way. They were gossiping in the same way. They were doing tatris together. They drank the same kind of coffee and tea, and they danced in the same way. These things bind us. They bind us as individuals, as a nation. These are our stories. And so reclaiming these stories is monumentally important.
I think it's so important that you say these things bind us, that they connect us, because even before I met you or before I meet other Palestinians, I am aware of this sort of ephemeral or vague connection that we share. And I think, you know, if you look at what any colonial power, Israel, or, you know, anyone is trying to do in the context of occupation and colonization, it's divide and conquer, right? It's divide geographically, divide politically. So yeah, our stories are that connective tissue. I mean, I think that resonates so much. And so I want to ask you about, before we move on, I just want to ask you one more thing about the Oxford Union thing, just for clarity's sake, for people who didn't watch you. And I would encourage everyone to go watch the full speech, because there were reports that Oxford Union bowed to Zionist threats and edited your speech and then censored sort of factual parts and altered the historic record after it had already reached enough views. They changed it. Yeah. So if you would, what happened sort of behind the scenes? I mean,
well, it's still happening, by the way. So
did you feel betrayed? I mean, is this just another example of silence in Palestine?
Yeah. Well, it's another example of Zionist wielding power over public discourse, over institutions that are thought to be venerable and uncompromising when it comes to speech and open debate.
I just want to say it's also institutions that Colombia and so many others that pride themselves and claim their whole raison d'être is about free speech and sort of, you know, and they'll use
it's bullshit.
Sadly.
And Gaza is really pulling those masks off, right? I mean, it's literally exposing everybody.
Yeah.
And their lies and their bullshit and this, you know, all these hammers that they beat the rest of the world over with, their free speech and their democracy. And it's all bullshit. It's all a big lie. And Gaza is showing us that. So with the Oxford Union, I signed a, I made them sign a rider that when I found out that I couldn't, you know, film my own speech or film anything, nobody was allowed. I made them sign a rider that under no circumstance would they edit any part of my speech, even if it's like, even if there are interruptions, whatever. And they agreed. The president of the union at the time was Ibrahim Osman Mawafi. And although apparently there were internal pressures not to publish my speech in full, he saw nothing wrong with it. They used the excuse that it violated the Anti-Terrorism Act or something like anti-incitement or something like that. But of course it didn't. And so they uploaded the speech in full. A few weeks later, Ibrahim's tenure ended and there was a new president. 5 days of uploading the speech, it had garnered over 250,000 views, and then it was taken down. And they put up another version. And at first I thought it was, oh, they'd put it back up. But And then I realized there were about 2 minutes missing from it. And somebody on X kindly sort of pulled out the precise missing parts, and they've refused to reinstate it. There is a legal battle ongoing in their procedures. They have something called a standing committee. And if the standing committee votes on something, that decision has to be a couple months ago, the standing committee voted to reinstate it fully. But of course, as we know, this is another moment of the bullshit and the lies of democracy and democratic processes ruling the people who really pull the string.
You know, you talk about the genocide in Gaza sort of pulling all the masks off. But what's crazy to me is, you know, with the sanctioning of Francesca and now more ICC, you know, ICC officials, it's just how desperate and how afraid they are of basic facts and truth. Like, not even taking the truth and facts and sort of like, you know, expanding and extrapolating. It's just the actual reality of what they're truly doing frightens them. It's
this has been their MO for a long time. And I'm glad you mentioned Francesca, and I'm glad you mentioned Anas and others like Ismail Al-Ghul and Muhammad Qreta and so many others. You know, those are the brave folks, truly. And I am inspired by them. You know, and Francesca has faced so much more than just this cancellation. They're going after her whole family. They're trying to get her husband fired. She doesn't talk about it, right? Because she doesn't want to center herself.
Yeah.
But this is what I'm saying, that, you know, but we still have to escalate. And there have to be more people have to step up to take some of the pressure off of her, off of everybody who is really taking all these risks. We have to escalate, because their process is to commit a crime, let people be outraged, and then commit a bigger crime. They escalate every time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The colonization of Palestine didn't start with this Holocaust that we're witnessing right now. It started with land seizures. It started with isolated massacres that behind closed doors, with night raids, torture, and, you know, administrative detention, and it just escalates and becomes more savage every year, and until we arrive at this. And so, and we have to do the same thing, right? We have to escalate our tactics.
Yeah.
No matter whatever they do to us, we escalate.
And I think escalate can mean so many things. I mean, because you bring up Francesca, I have so much admiration for her for so many reasons.
Yeah.
But to your point, it can't just be her. And, you know, there's people who adore her and admire her. But then, you know, sometimes I try to, like you say, rightfully just encourage them to reflect on, like, well, it's great for you to be inspired by her, but, like, maybe take some of the weight off her.
Yeah.
You know, maybe show up beyond.
Well, that's the point. That's the point of being inspired, right? Is
right.
to follow suit. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And also that piece in the Free Beacon or whatever about Max, I don't know if you saw it, her husband this week. I mean, I think there's so many different ways that we can escalate, right? Even the film by Anne-Marie Jasset, I don't know if you know Palestine 36, which is now the official selection for Palestine for the Oscars. I had a tiny role in it, and just being on set there.
I was supposed to be in it, by the way.
Apparently we were all supposed to be in it. By we were all, I just mean she got every Palestinian I know to be in it.
So. I know.
No, but I guess what I'm saying is, like, you know, there's so many different realms within which we can escalate. The modalities of storytelling are endless. What I really admire about you, beyond your incredible talent as a writer and a communicator, as a novelist, you encourage boycotts, protests, direct action. But then I wonder, when we see groups like Palestine Action in the UK, for example, shutting down arms factories or, like, you know, spray painting them red, to try to stop and choke this sort of flow of death. When we see the criminalization of dissent and how people, governments, say it is terrorism to protest genocide, and yet the definition of terrorism, if I'm not mistaken, is, you know, using unlawful violence to achieve political aims, which is exactly what Israel's done since 1948, right?
Yeah.
Using unlawful violence to achieve political aims. I mean, do you think we will reach a point where Israel's whole jig is up.
We will reach it. I have no doubt about that. I have no doubt that Israel will not be here much longer. Right. The problem is, how much harm are they going to do in the meantime? That's assuming we continue to to fight this in every way that we can. The brilliance of Palestine Action is that they do escalate, right? They are willing to pay the price. They know they might go to jail, and they're still doing it. And frankly, what they're doing has at least in the UK, it has a precedent. It has a very successful precedent. We have to escalate. We have to support these groups. We have to be willing to pay a price, because ultimately, if more people do that, they can't put us all in prison, right? And the other thing that what you're talking about demonstrates is the idea that the legal system is really a mechanism that serves the ruling elite, right? It is a mechanism they have at their disposal to bring us all back into line when we're a threat to them, right? So Palestine Action is a threat. And so this is what they do. So no, I'm not surprised. I'm not at all surprised. Orwell told us about this. Fanon told us about this. W.E.B. Du Bois told us about this, right? This is...
You know what's interesting to me about Palestine Action? I was in London giving a speech a few weeks ago, and then I went to a rally. And, you know, I'm sure you've seen the 500 arrests on one day, I think, in August, for people waving placards that say, I oppose genocide, you know, Palestine Action is not terrorism. It's exposing the fragility, of course, of these so-called free societies, as we've discussed. This is what I always say about, like, you know, people are saying, oh, people like you are, you know, people like speaking out about Palestine are changing the narrative. No, I think Israel's own belligerence is what's changing the narrative. And ironically, I know a lot of people in the UK who weren't plugged in or tuned in or didn't even feel a certain way about Palestine and Israel. But by taking this step, they do feel a certain way about, you know, their free speech being curtailed. So when these governments fail to act in the UK, in Europe, in the Arab world, as well as you often, you know, talk about, and we're seeing trade with Israel still flowing, with Arab countries, with Turkey, with, you know, with all these countries, not just flowing, growing since 2020. Too many countries to name, Jordan, so many countries. I mean, even those countries that have huge Palestinian populations. So how does the complicity wound the collective soul of our people? Because I can only imagine what it must feel like if I'm so enraged to see it as a Palestinian, as a human here. Imagine being in Gaza.
People in Gaza feel horribly betrayed. Like it is so wounding to them. And also it's not just, I mean, they see complicity also in the West Bank. I mean, I'm not going to lie.
Like, I know.
You know, that's another matter, and that's more of an internal conversation that we have with ourselves, not like in the open.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think, so this kind of goes back to what I was saying, that, you know, Gaza is a turning point. It's a pivot point for all of humanity, basically. And it will, and the outcome of this Holocaust will determine whether or not we continue to allow these corrupt governments to lord over us. Gaza is an opportunity for humanity, for people of the world, for people of conscience. Change the world order, right? To really, you know, like, I'm just going to say this, like, I dream of masses just storming their fucking palaces. Really, that's what should happen to these Arab leaders. They don't deserve this grand history that in lands that they are destroying at the behest of colonial powers. History tells us it's possible to end all this, to change the world, to dream another dream. And it really begins with psychology. It begins with decolonizing our minds. It begins with harnessing our anger. It begins with understanding our connections. It begins with solidarity. It begins with loving our ancestors. It begins with radical empathy for each other, and it begins with shedding all of these things that they tell us are important. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, one of the things I hear so much in Gaza, like people in Gaza have become really quite philosophically deep in that, you know, they are living an experience in which the world, like, they are seeing what's truly important in the world, right? Mm-hmm. All the things that they tell us are important, the things that we're supposed to dream and strive for, they're not real. They're not real. It's all superficial. It's all a lie. And I think once you see that,
you can't unsee it.
You can't unsee it, and it alters you. It makes you a deeper human being that is more alive and more in love with the world, in love with not with what's happening, but in love with the potential of our planet, the potential of what we could be. If we just shed these lies that we think are truth, that we think are inevitable. It's not. We are truly powerful beings in our collective. And these people that we think are powerful, that we cannot defeat, are literally paper. They're just like spider webs. We can swipe them away. But we have to understand that, I think.
No, I think that's so critical. And also self-love, I know it sounds cheesy, and self-respect. I can't tell you how many people in the last 2 years I used to have respect for, but through observing their lack of self-respect in this moment, as it relates to Palestine and many other things, I just have a big question mark around them. Don't have a question mark around him, though. What a cutie.
Yeah, it's just Mika. She's a girl. She's my girl. She's my granddaughter.
Well, speaking of bitches, if I may make that, I was really going to ask you about this next. You've used the hashtag America is Israel's bitch in posts criticizing how U.S. policy, of course, is outsourced to Netanyahu when we see them firing officials in the U.S. for opposing displacement or even just for showing empathy and regretting that yet another journalist was killed. How does that hashtag capture sort of the anger at America's unprecedented, if I could say, subservience to Israel? And what feelings does it evoke for you as someone watching from within them?
I mean, you know, for those of us who have been awake for a long time, we have always known that United States is America's bitch because we read, right?
It's Israel's bitch. You said America is United States is America's bitch, which is funny.
Oh, no, it's Israel's bitch. Yeah, right. And basically, I mean, I'm just making the point that the United States is totally subservient to Israel. Like, they have hijacked the America's sovereignty. And we've known this for a long time. We've read Paul Findlay. We've read Mearsheimer. We know, right?
Even he knows. She wants to go on a walk. I get it. We're wrapping up.
Okay. Like, but we have known this for a long time. Remarkably, Americans are finally start to seeing, especially, and this is the surprising part, the right wing. And I love it. I love what Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing and Tucker Carlson. Yeah. I don't agree with them on a lot of things, but I think, like, I grew up when I was in, you know, the part of my life that I lived in this country was primarily in the South, right? And I grew up with folks like them, kind of good old boys, conservative, in love with America and believing in these American ideals. And they're finally, and they're, you know, they're good people for the most part, right? I think they're misguided on a lot of things.
Yeah.
But they do have an abiding goodness. Mm-hmm. And I think for the first time, they are starting to see that, wait, the shit we thought was real is actually a big lie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and these are people with power, right? These are people who have the guns in this country.
No, I know. And I think the political and social reckoning that's going to come eventually in the U.S. because of what you just described is not going to be a small thing. I think it's going to have lasting ramifications on what America is and can be in this world. So you said plainly that the Iraq war was fought for Israel, and you tied it to deeper history, like Zionists pulling America into World War One for the Balfour Declaration. What do you mean by all that? I mean,
so I think people in this country are starting to understand that the Iraq war was fought for Israel. You know, people are starting to talk about it in ways that is refreshing. And this topic of the wars that the United States has fought on behalf of Zionism could really take up a whole nother hour or more even. There's a long audit of evidence, indisputable evidence that Israel dragged us into that. And it's something, you know, Israel, any threat, any country, any Arab country that becomes powerful, Israel perceives it as a threat because their existence is based on total dominance. Their existence is based on inspiring fear in the people that surround them, and that's how they dominate. And when you have somebody like Gaddafi or Saddam, who are developing militaries, who aren't afraid, right? They Israel wants to take them out, but they can't, right? So they bring in their bitch, their attack dog. And you know, there is that white paper, the 1996 white paper, called Securing the Realm. I mean, they outlined literally what they wanted the United States to do, and it was written by Zionists, by neocon Zionists. There is no doubt that Israel pushed us into that war. And you know, Netanyahu, how many times did he testify in Congress when he says, I guarantee you, Iraq is just months away from nuclear weapons and blah, blah, blah. Like, and they say the same thing about Iran. And it just goes on and on, right? But I think what people don't understand is that it's not just the Iraq war. There's this whole sordid history of other wars. World War I was engineered, and the United States was pulled into it ultimately because of Zionism. Woodrow Wilson. So during the election in 1912, and this is something I keep thinking I want to do, like,
sure.
Maybe we can talk, because I don't know how to do that. Maybe
By the way, there are people who, like you, recognize the value in sort of like, you know, telling the real story.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know, maybe you can put us in touch or something, but I really want to expose this little known story. Basically, you know, the 1912 election, William Howard Taft was the incumbent, and he was going to win, right? And so these elite Zionists and bankers who were not necessarily Zionists, but mostly Zionists, who also wanted to get the Federal Reserve, engineered basically what can only be described as a coup. They wanted their boy, Woodrow Wilson. He was this sycophantic, you know, idiot who he was the president of Princeton University, who had also had an affair with this woman who was the wife of a professor at Princeton. Her name was Mary Hulbert Peck. And there were these letters that some say were used as blackmail. Some say were just, you know, tell you about that. But that's a side story. But they got their boy Woodrow Wilson into office by the same cabal, right, of wealthy. And they would be billionaires by today's standards, but they were millionaires at the time. Went to Teddy Roosevelt. Who was kind of like this, you know, this swashbuckling kind of the Trump of his time, and said, hey, you're our guy. Nobody can run this country like you. He was already kind of sore because he didn't get the Republican nomination. And, you know, we're going to back you so you can lead the country. And he formed this third political party called the Bull Moose Party. And he basically split the Republican vote, right? And which got Woodrow Wilson into office. And he actually got the lowest majority ever in American history. He won by 41%, basically. And they did that by splitting the vote. And ironically, if you fast forward to the 90s, that's how they got Bill Clinton defeated George Bush. Right? Yeah. There's only two times in history where a third party was actually allowed into the debates and into the mainstream running. And both times were brought in by Zionists. So George Bush Sr. Blocked a $10 billion loan guarantee to Israel. And for those who don't know what the loan guarantees are, it doesn't mean that Israel is getting a loan from us and they pay back. No, a loan guarantee means that they get this money, right? And then if they don't pay it back, then the United States pays it back. And they've done this over, and they always default, and then we pay it back. So George, it's basically like a $10 billion like giveaway.
Yeah.
And Bush Sr. blocked it. It was the only thing. This guy was the most pro-Israel dude. He let them do whatever, but this one thing he blocked. And they were going to punish him for it. Nobody crosses AIPAC, right?
It's crazy to me. It's the same thing with the New York Times. When the New York Times manufactures consent for genocide for 2 years, and then they do this one tiny thing, which is like, you know, the thing about the kid and the starvation and the conditions. And then, like, everybody in Israel and all the Zionists are like, they must be held accountable. It is.
And they whip them. They whip them until they wrote that stupid retraction.
Yeah.
But that's what happened. And the ties with Ross Perot and AIPAC are well known. They're established. they pushed him into that so they could split the Republican vote and get their boy Bill Clinton into office. And that's how Bill Clinton was elected. And one of the first things he did when he got into office was to approve that $10 billion loan guarantee. But then, but go back to 1912. So they got Woodrow Wilson into office. And one of the first things Woodrow Wilson did was to approve the Federal Reserve Act, right? Which basically relinquished American sovereignty to this cartel of bankers who now controlled the world, basically,
right.
The world currency, at least, right?
Yeah.
And allowed them to basically loan unlimited amounts of money because they were creating money out of thin air. And it's a whole, like, it's incredible when you start to, like, it's kind of a genius plan economically, but it is so nefarious. But anyway, so coincidence, not a coincidence, World War One breaks out literally months after.
I used to believe in coincidences. Now I believe in conspiracies.
No, and I don't have time to go into.
I appreciate you sharing that with us. I think people are going to be fascinated because I want people to, you know, be able to dig deeper. And that's what, I mean, you piqued my curiosity.
But I want to tell you, I want to just continue this thread because, please. So it was being fought in Europe and Britain was, they weren't winning, right? Germany was doing quite well. And the British knew that the only way they could win this war is if the United States entered. But I'm going to rewind just a little bit. There's a guy by the name of Samuel Untermeyer. He was this wealthy Wall Street Zionist attorney. And he was a big backer of Woodrow Wilson. And he frequented his office quite a bit. And Woodrow Wilson Zionists were trying to push him to appoint Louis Brandeis as the first Jewish Supreme Court justice, right? Louis Brandeis was also, he was the head of the ZOA. He was a big Zionist. Samuel Untermeyer also happened to be, coincidentally, the lawyer of Mary Hulbert Peck, who I mentioned earlier had an affair with, you know, and having extramarital affairs back then was very different than it is now, right? It was a much bigger deal. And there were apparently some raunchy letters. And he was in possession of all those letters. So initially, Woodrow Wilson was hesitant, rather, I should say, to the appointment of Louis Brandeis because he didn't think it was going to be accepted. And it was problematic in other ways. So Untermeyer gives him a visit, November of 1915, I want to say. Shortly after that visit, suddenly Woodrow Wilson is full force advocating for the appointment of Louis Brandeis. And there was a U.S. senator who actually gave a speech indicating that Untermeyer basically showed him those letters and said, look, Mary Hulbert Peck needs $40,000. The president could not pay it. That was a massive sum at the time. And he said, look, I'll pay this on your behalf because I'm a good friend and I love you and I support you and I'll do this thing for you. The only thing I ask is that, you know, here's Louis Brandeis. Just give him a shot. So Louis Brandeis becomes the first Jewish Supreme Court justice. And he and Woodrow Wilson were actually good friends, right? They became close. And he was one of the main people in Wilson's ear. And Louis Brandeis, a lot of people don't know, was one of the original authors of the Balfour Declaration.
Mm-hmm.
So we had this transcontinental, Zionist cabal that were liaising with each other and the point was to push the United States. And there's reports, there's cables, there's something called the Wiseman reports. Wiseman was this he was this British spy basically who was based in the US in DC. And his reports have been declassified and he wrote back basically that the Zionists will give us their full backing in exchange for the declaration. Right. Mm-hmm. And Zionist backing meant that they were going to push the United States into World War One. That's why the United States entered World War One. So what's popularly taught is that it was the sinking of the Lusitania, right?
The
sinking of the Lusitania happened 2 years before. And the fact that they would use that should tell you that they're lying. You know what I mean? It happened 2 years before the US actually entered
the war. Right.
And the other thing was something called the Zimmermann cable. So Zimmermann was a German a German diplomat.
This is the military contract between Germany, Mexico, the U.S., right?
Yes, exactly. But it was also, whether it was real or not, there's no, coincidentally,
yeah.
no
no original copy remains, right? All we had was, all the Americans saw was the British translation.
Yeah, they intercepted the telegram.
Yes, right, exactly. Right. And that was it. Even though there was literally no evidence that it could be real. Like, Mexico didn't have, like, there were no weapons. They didn't have, there was nothing to undergird that. It was just, you know, the British translation of an intercepted telegram, of which there is no original copy. And they also coerced Zimmerman himself to make a confession, which is unprecedented for a diplomat to just kind of go and say, oh yeah, I wrote it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so those were the excuses for the US entering the war, which are complete lies. And the same thing for World War II. Like, it's just, it is.
No, it blows my mind that people are always bewildered that, like, oh, these things that you're suggesting could have been true. These, that they lied to go into the war and they lied about the reason. But, like, they're lying today left and right. So I don't know why it's a stretch for people to imagine history. I think it's just because we learned it, as to your point, we learned it a certain way. And people just are less reluctant to let go of those, like, foundational learning.
Well, this is what I'm saying about the scientific psychological principles that they operate under. There's studies showing how people don't are taught not to connect the dots. Mm-hmm. People are taught to subconsciously internalize things that they don't know that they have internalized. And it's done through Hollywood. It's done through the media. Like, why do people, when you say Palestinians, why do they immediately think terrorists?
Yeah, why, right? When they see that scarf?
We've never done anything to
when
them.
When they see that scarf.
We've never hurt Americans. We've never done anything to, we've never done anything to anybody in the world except defend our land, right? But the, but then you say Palestinians and they immediately think horrible, irrational, violent, scary people. And it is because the seeds of that are planted through everything they see. It is planted through the discourse in the media. It is planted through Hollywood, film after film after film. And so when you show them pictures of us getting bombed and torn and destroyed, it doesn't resonate.
Well, speaking of that, I'm really grateful to you for giving us that trip down history lane. I think it's so useful for hopefully so many people. I want to bring it back to Hamas and resistance for a second before we end. As we've said, you've praised Hamas's unyielding resistance, the young fighters. I mean, I think it was in February, you said that their persistence is going to force Israel out of Gaza. And I guess the question is simply, why is supporting the right to armed resistance so vital? And how do you respond to those who say, this is, you know, this makes you discredited, or this is divisive, or this is, you know, the critics? How do you respond? Or maybe you don't.
I mean, yeah, you're right. I don't generally respond, but I will, you know, I'll respond here to you in that it's incredible that we, like, people will recognize the inordinate amount of violence that is poured on us for so long. The sadism, the cruelty under which Palestinians are forced to live, that rather than focusing on that, they want to police how we resist, right? They want to tell the oppressed how we respond to that. They want to criticize any anger we feel about it. They want to criticize us taking up arms to shoot the person who's got a knife in our throats, right? You have to frame it that way to them, right? Because and these are people who would shoot you for walking on their property, right? And they would feel entitled to do that. And yet they think that we need to be nonviolent. I wholly reject that. And I wholly reject Palestinians who insist that we have to be nonviolent.
I agree.
And I'll tell you why, because it doesn't work and it has not worked. We have tried that for 75 years and it has not worked. It has been an abject failure. Peaceful means, diplomatic means, legal means have been abject failures.
So cute.
She thinks I was, because I'm animated, she thinks I'm mad. Coming to apologize. She thinks.
I saw that apologetic face. No, it has been a failure. And I think it's, you know, the reason they want us to continue down the nonviolent thing is the same reason. I think it's the same people who want us to only talk about a two-state solution, even as the state is being erased, the people is being erased, the land is being erased. And yet here we have, you know, have all these Arab leaders as well as other leaders only focusing on a two-state solution.
Also, this is a distraction. This whole thing now that they're going to recognize
the Palestinians. I know, and I find it disgusting.
It's a big distraction. We don't want a two-state anymore. We want the whole thing. We want our homeland back. If y'all want to stay, We're not making refugees of other people, but you will not stay as our masters, right? You will stay as equals, and you will be subject to laws like everybody else. That's it. That we should demand nothing but the full menu of human dignity and human rights, because we deserve it. We are an ancient indigenous people who have lived on that land continuously for millennia and verifiably. We didn't come from Poland. We didn't come from Ukraine. We didn't come with these stupid fairy tales of you know, being indigenous. It's stupid. This fairy tale that they have managed to convince the world of is shocking that people believe it.
I know.
And I can only explain that by believing that there is systematic education or miseducation of people to basically unplug their faculties,
yep,
their critical thinking capacity. Mm-hmm. That's it. And I think, yeah.
It's sad but true, and I wish it was only true about Palestine, but it's true about so many things. Let's bring it back to the spirit at the end so that Sasha can get out. Drawing from this spirit that we discussed, of Gaza's spirit, if you will, the fighters who push on with one arm, the mothers who, you know, protect and shield their young as the bombs drop. What message do you have, Susan, for those who are burning with fury, but for some reason are paralyzed or unsure how to act? I mean, how do they, for people listening, channel their rage into resistance, wherever they may exist, whether they're Palestinian or not, that reclaims our collective humanity?
We all have different realities. We all have different risk acceptance. We all have different economic, different psychological, different political realities. But I think we can be undergirded by a few principles. First of all, there are boundless ways to resist, right? It could be something as small as educating yourself and reading and sharing posts. It could be as big as taking up arms, you know, doing really radical things. You have the on one end, you have extreme acts like Aaron Bushnell.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole spectrum of what people can do. But I would always say that you have to escalate, right? Like, you have to understand the psychology, the mind frame that they're putting you in. Sense of powerlessness is a lie. It's not real. You have to understand that you are not powerless. You are made to believe that you are powerless because they operate under these psychological principles, like the boiling frog or the soup. There's a psychology concept called learned helplessness. But these are a result of really cruel animal experiments that basically programmed animals into believing that nothing they do, no matter how much they cried, barked, ran, whatever, they were still going to get electrocuted. And it was still going to rip through their bodies. And so eventually they just lay there and they take a shock over and over and over and just hope that it stops.
That's what they're counting on.
Right. And so that's what I mean by, but the way, what they're doing is not random. It is based on scientific and studied and proven principles, right? And so they are inducing a learned helplessness in the masses. And they are inducing and they are creating the boiling frog principle for us. And they're also creating something called the bystander effect. And this is another studied psychological principle where people are less likely to help a victim if there's a lot of other people around. And it's because the responsibility to act becomes diffused, right? So everybody looks to the other for somebody to do something. You do, right? And so And then when they see somebody else not doing something, then their own inaction is reinforced. So you have to understand these principles, these ideas, this reality that they have put us all in, right? So you have to understand it first. And then you have to think and understand how to break out of it. And there's other equally effective psychological principles that allow you to break out of those, right? Read Frantz Fanon, I would say. Read the first follower principle. Like, there's ways that we can break out of this, but I would just say you have to escalate. You have to speak your truth boldly. You have to be willing to accept a cost and decide what that cost is. Are you okay spending a few days in jail to make this protest? Are you okay going to jail for longer periods? Are you okay? You know what I mean? You have to accept what the what the what what costs you? Are you okay getting canceled from your job? There's just that physician in the UK who lost her job.
Yeah, so many physicians.
She's amazing, but she's unapologetic. She's out there basically like, F you, I will lose my job. I will lose my house. I'm here in the streets for Palestine, right? Mm-hmm. That's what we need. It's that spirit that we need.
When you said earlier, you know, they can't jail us all. It's also a line that was in my speech in the UK in the context of Palestine Action. And it sounds a bit reductive, but I just want to drive this point home at the end, because I'm sure you'll agree. Like, you know how 500 people were arrested when 1,500 showed up to hold the placards in Parliament Square in the UK? Mm-hmm. Imagine 20,000. Yeah. Imagine 60,000. Imagine 200,000 people, which those numbers were in the streets for Palestine. You know, they can't arrest 200,000 people holding placards. You know what I mean? So the power in numbers thing is easy to say. And I think people tend to click, you know, they kind of glaze over it, but...
Even the trolling that some people are doing by wearing those plasticine action.
Yeah.
It's not Palestine. It's plastic. And it looks just like it.
Yeah.
And it has the, you know, the police scratching their heads. Like, what the hell do we do? No. You know, like, troll them.
Yeah.
You know, like, go
There's
out
so
in
many
the
ways.
Streets. Yeah. So many. Exactly. There's so many ways. There are infinite ways to resist this. And you know, you don't just do it ultimately for Gaza. And this is another point I really want to drive home. We do it for ourselves, too. Because liberation, personal and collective liberation, comes from standing up for the weakest, the most defenseless among us, mm-hmm. right? That's part of our own process of liberation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to end it there because why not end on liberation?
Yes.
Susan, thank you so much. Your words really are a beacon in the darkness. And I want to thank you for being so raw and also so human at a time when they're trying to dehumanize us.
Back at you.
But there's so much that we've learned during this conversation. Also follow her on X. She's pretty prolific these days.
And that wraps today's episode of This Week in Palestine. Stay curious, stay bold, and keep asking the questions that challenge power and move us closer to justice. I'm your host, Yara Rashid, and it's been an honor to share this space where truth is uncompromising, resistance is unapologetic, and solidarity is essential. We'd love to hear from you. Reach out anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. Deep thanks to our listeners and the incredible team behind the scenes: Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Law, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Mosa, Dr. Rana Awad, Dr. Bethany Marks, Juliette Salame Olivier, Rinad Al-Ghul, and Muhammad Al-Ghul. Your work keeps this platform alive. Until next time, keep walking toward truth. Keep walking toward Palestine. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, broadcasting from WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. We'll be back next week. Stay safe and stay steadfast.